either, but that didn't stop Papa from snubbing me, along with Mystery and Herbal. I was guilty by association. If Papa and I happened to bump into each other, as he snuck around the back of the house, he'd walk past with a brusque hello, staring vacantly through me. He wasn't angry. He was just operating on some sort of program that didn't include me. The curious thing is, most robots don't program themselves. In the meantime, every single rule we had laid down at the house meeting, requiring approval for guests, giving the house a percentage of seminar money, not hitting on another Pua's woman, was bypassed and ignored. We had no idea how many students, sergers, and instructors Papa was packing into his room. They scurried around the house like peacocked rats. We didn't even bother to lock the doors anymore. His latest recruits were two interns who looked like younger versions of himself. No one knew their names. They were known simply as the Mini Papas. The Mini Papas were just as cold to me as Papa was, but they were constantly around. They watched my every move, as if it were an assignment they'd been given. Sometimes I'd see them sitting at Mel's Diner with Tyler Durden. The three of them would be talking about me. He'll reposition his body to steer the conversation in his direction. He'll leave at times to show scarcity. If you make a joke, he exaggerates it to steal the glory. If someone asks him to do a routine, he'll say, in the field, so that it's on his time and the person appreciates it more. They weren't criticizing me. They were trying to model me. Yet oddly, they never hung out with me as friends. They just wanted to listen and absorb and take notes. It was dehumanizing. But then again, no one in that house seemed entirely human to begin with. I needed to get out of there. Fortunately, Rolling Stone wanted me to tackle another tough subject. Her name was Courtney Love. The interview was scheduled to take place for 1 hour at the Virgin Records office in New York. Courtney was at the peak of her infamy at the time. That week, she'd bared her breast to David Letterman on network TV, appeared on the front page of the New York Post with one of her mammaries in the mouth of a stranger outside Wendy's, and been arrested for allegedly hitting a fan in the head with a microphone stand during a concert. Then there were the pending drug charges hanging over her head and her loss of custody of her daughter. The Rolling Stone story was the first interview she'd agreed to do since all the trouble went down. When I met her at Virgin, Courtney wore a black dress with a sash wrapped tastefully around her torso. Her lips were painted red and full. Considering the number of ugly tabloid headlines featuring her name, Courtney looked good. Pale, thin, statuesque. Soon, however, the sash was loose and dangling behind her like a tail, and the lipstick was smeared. It seemed like a metaphor for her life, constantly unraveling. "If you guys are waiting for me to die, you're going to have to wait a long time," she began. "I was the press. I was the enemy. My grandmother didn't die until she was 102. This is what Pua's called a bitch shield. It was nothing personal, just a protective mechanism. I couldn't let it faze me. I had to get rapport and show her I was human, not just another blood-sucking journalist. I still have nightmares about my grandmother," I told her, "because the last time I had the chance to see her alive, we had plans to go to the Art Institute of Chicago, and I blew her off because I wanted to sleep late. We fluffed for a while about families. She didn't like hers very much. Now we were getting somewhere." As the interview continued, I hit the hook point. She looked up at me and the walls came down. Her face flushed, the muscles in her cheeks clamped, and the tears started dripping. "I need to be saved," she sobbed. "You need to save me." Now we had rapport. Rapport equals trust plus comfort. When our hour was up, Courtney suggested exchanging phone numbers. She said she'd call me later that night to continue the interview. I was relieved because an hour-long discussion in a record company office wouldn't have made for a very interesting profile. At least Tom Cruise had taken me motorcycle riding and Scientology sightseeing. That night, I met some old college friends at Soho House, a private club in the Warehouse District of Manhattan. I hadn't seen them since I'd joined the community, and they hardly recognized me. They spent half an hour discussing how awkward and introverted I used to be. Then their conversation turned to work and movies. I tried to contribute, but I had trouble focusing on the words. They just floated into my ear and accumulated there uselessly like wax. I felt like I didn't fit in with them anymore. Fortunately, an Amazonian woman with tree trunk thighs and a lethal boob job, soon stumbled past the table. She was a foot taller than me and somewhat drunk. "Have you seen a girl in a black cowboy hat?" she asked in a staccato Swedish accent. "Hang out with us," I said. "We're more fun than your friends." It was a line I'd learned from David D'Angelo, and it worked. My friends looked on in shock as she sat down and asked for a cigarette. For the rest of the night, the Amazon and I talked. Every now and then, she'd drag me to the bathroom, where I'd watch her inhale cocaine like a human dustbuster. "Do you watch Sex and the City?" she asked as we left the bathroom for the third time that night. "Sometimes," I told her. "I just got a pearl," she said with pride. "That's great." I had no idea what a pearl was. "It's cool," she said, "with those little beads." "Oh, the beads. Those things are great." I was totally confused, but I liked listening to her, enjoying the mismatch between her harsh accent and her spongy lips. Maybe she was talking about anal beads. Good for her. I stopped and leaned against the wall of the corridor we were walking through. "How good of a kisser are you, on a scale of 1 to 10? "I'm a 10, she said. "I like soft, slow teasing kisses. I hate it when someone rams their tongue down my throat." "Yeah, I had a girlfriend who did that. It was like making out with a cow." "I give amazing blowjobs," she said. "Respect." That one-word answer had taken me months to figure out. Some women like to make extremely sexual comments after meeting a man. It was a shit test. If the guy became uncomfortable, he failed. However, if he took the bait and got excited or said something sexual in response, he also failed. After watching the British comedian Ali G, I discovered the solution. Just look her in the eye, nod approvingly, and, with a slight smile creeping across her face, say, "respect," in a smart-ass tone. I had responses now for nearly every challenge a woman could throw my way. But this was hardly a challenge. It was fool's mate. My job was simply to not do anything wrong. I fell silent and did what the Pooahs call triangular gazing, looking slowly from her left eye to her right eye, and then to her lips to create suggestive sexual tension. She threw herself against me. The next thing she did was ram her tongue down my throat like a cow. Then she pulled away. "Talking about kissing got me excited," she said. "Let's get out of here," I replied, peeling myself off the wall. We took the elevator downstairs and hailed a cab. She gave the driver an address in the East Village. I guess we were going to her place. She straddled me in the back seat and pulled a heavy breast out of her tank top. I guess I was supposed to suck it. We arrived at her house and climbed the stairs to her apartment. She turned on a lamp, which cast a dull brown glow over the room, and slipped the Rolling Stones' Goat Head Soup into her stereo. "I'm just going to put my pearl on," she told me. "I can't wait," I said, and I couldn't. As I lay there, I realized I'd forgotten to say goodbye to my friends. In fact, I'd ignored them all night. Sarging had dropped a polyester curtain between me and my past. But when my new friend emerged in her pearl, I decided, in the heat of the moment, that it was worth it. The pearl wasn't anal beads at all. It was a pair of panties with an exposed crotch and a chain of small metal balls connecting the front side to the back. She'd probably left the house that night, hoping to find someone to take home to show it off to. Obliging, I rubbed the balls gently against her labia and her clit. I figured that was what it was for, though I wasn't really sure, because a minute later, the chain of balls snapped off the underwear. It dangled between her legs like a tampon string. So much for her new pearl. "I'm going to change," she said. She didn't seem upset. Inhaling an 8-ball of cocaine will do that to someone. She reemerged in knee-high black leather boots, lay down on the bed, and took another dustbuster snort from a burgundy vial of coke. Then she lifted the vial over her chest and tapped a small pile of powder onto the crest of her left breast. "I'm not a fan of drugs. Part of being a Pooah is learning to control your own state, so you don't need alcohol or drugs to have a good time. But if I were ever going to do cocaine, now would be the time." Every woman is different in bed. Each has her own tastes and quirks and fantasies. And someone's surface appearance never accurately indicates the raging storm or dead calm that lies beneath. Reaching that moment of passionate truth, of surrender, honesty, revelation, was my favorite part of the game. I loved seeing what new person emerged in bed, and then talking with that new person after our mutual orgasms. I guess I just like people. I leaned over her breast and plugged my left nostril. I was really dreading this. I didn't want to be up all night, and I had a feeling that coke wasn't good for a gentleman's staying power. Not that I was a gentleman. And then the phone rang. My phone. "I have to get this," I told her. I jumped up, spilling her fairy dust all over the sheets, and grabbed my cell. I had a feeling I knew who was calling. "Hey, can you come over?" It was Courtney Love. "See if you can get some acupuncture needles in Chinatown, the big ones that hurt the most, and get some alcohol and cotton swabs." Chapter 8. "This one's for the gallbladder," Courtney Love said as she slammed an acupuncture needle into my leg. "Shouldn't this be done by a licensed professional?" "I've been doing this since I was young," she replied. "But you're the first person I've done it to in a while." She wiggled the needle around. "Tell me when you feel it." "There." An electric shock to the leg. "Okay, enough." My scheduled one-hour interview with Courtney Love had turned into a surreal slumber party. Outside of food runs, I didn't leave her Chinatown loft for 72 hours. It was 5,000 square feet, with nothing in it but a bed, a television, and a couch. Dressed down in a t-shirt and sweatpants, she was in hiding. From the paparazzi, from her manager, from the government, from the bank, from a man, from herself. I was stripped down to my boxers on her couch, with a dozen needles sticking out of me. Over time, the floor around her bed grew dense with crumbs, cigarette butts, clothing, food wrappers, needles, and root beer bottles. Meanwhile, the color of her fingers and toes changed from flesh to blackened ash. She was too scared even to answer her phone, in case someone called her, she said, with some bullshit news about some fucking thing. It was just the two of us, journalist and rock star, player and playette. She put Boogie Nights into her DVD player, then climbed into her bed and threw a stained blanket over herself. "I always ask the guy I'm dating, what's your biggest fear?" she said. "My last boyfriend said it's drifting, which he's doing now. The video director I'm currently obsessed with said failure, and I'm living mine. It's loss of power." Of all the problems in Courtney's life, the one that seemed to consume her most was romantic. The video director wasn't returning her calls. It was a problem common to all women, no matter what they look like or how famous they were. "I have a theory," she said. "You have to sleep with a guy 3 times for him to fall in love with you. And I only slept with him 2. I need 1 more night to get him." "If you want to get him," I said, "read The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene. It'll give you some strategy." She stubbed her cigarette out on the floor. "I need all the help I can get." The Art of Seduction was classic Pua reading material, along with Greene's other book, The 48 Laws of Power. For the former, Greene studied the greatest seductions of history and literature in search of common themes. His book classified different types of seducers, among them rakes, ideal lovers, and naturals. Different types of targets, the drama queen, the rescuer, the crushed star, and different types of approaches, all of which jibed with community philosophy. Approach indirectly, send mixed signals, appear to be an object of desire, isolate the victim. "How do you know about that book?" she asked. "I've spent the last 1.5 years hanging out with the world's greatest pickup artists." She sat up in her bed. "Tell me, tell me, tell me," she squealed like a schoolgirl. Talking about pickup was better than the alternative. Whenever the discussion veered toward her legal, media, and custody problems, her eyes filled with tears. She listened rapt as I told her about the community and Project Hollywood. It wasn't easy to have a serious conversation with a dozen acupuncture needles sticking out of my body. "I want to meet them," she said excitedly. "Do you think they're as good as Warren Beatty?" "I don't know. I've never met him." Courtney climbed out of bed and rubbed patchouli oil around the needles in my feet, legs, and chest. "Let me tell you, he's smooth. I would love to know how he operates." "He's great. He once called me and said, 'Hey, it's me,' as if I should have known who it was. Then he tried to convince me to come over to his house that night. When I finally said yes, he laughed and said he was in Paris. It's a total mindfuck. He'll blow his nose and then hand the dirty tissue to his date." It was a neg. Warren Beatty negged women. Every Pua, whether he's aware of it or not, uses the same principles. The difference between those in the community and lone wolves like Warren Beatty, when he was single, Brett Ratner, and David Blaine, is that we name our techniques and share our information. I don't know what this director's problem is, Courtney was saying. I have a magic pussy. If you fuck me, you become a king. I'm a kingmaker. Translation, if you fuck her, you become famous. She began pulling the needles out of my body. Relief. You have to get one in your head. It's the best feeling. Fumbling around the floor, Courtney grabbed a dirty needle. She aimed it just above my eye. No thanks. I've had enough for today. You gotta try it. It's great for the liver. My liver's fine, thanks. She dropped the needle back to the floor. Fine. I'm going out to get some Rice Krispie treats then. She wriggled out of her pink shirt and stood in front of me topless. These are natural breasts, but with a silicone lift, she said, hovering over me and revealing a scar underneath her left mammary. Do you know how much a shot of my tits is worth? $9,000. Then your financial problems are solved, I suggested. That won't even get me in the door at the lawyer's office, she snapped, slipping into a black and white baby doll dress. When she returned from the store, she was flush with excitement. She pulled a coffee cake out of her bag and split it in half, leaving a trail of crumbs behind her as she made for the safety of her bed. Let's make a bet, she said. What? I will bet you that I can get this director back. I doubt you can. If he's not returning your calls, he's not interested. He even denied he'd slept with me in the post. She handed me half of the coffee cake in her blackened fingers. But I'd like a challenge. Well, if you can get him back, you're a better pickup artist than I am. Then let's bet, she insisted. What are the stakes? If I can't get him back, I will give you a 1 week stand with me, wherever you want. I looked at her blankly. I was so taken aback by the notion that I had trouble processing the words. Or you can pick the middle name of my next child. It's your choice. Okay, but I have one condition. I get an hour of advice with each pickup artist you're living with. When it came time for me to leave her loft and catch my plane, Courtney climbed out of bed and kissed me goodbye. I just need to be fucked, she said as I waited for the elevator that would take me out of her loft. I just need a bossy guy to come here and fuck me. I knew I could have been that guy. The IOIs were there, but there's a PUA code of honor, there's a gambler's code of honor, and there's a journalist's code of honor, and having sex with her would have been violating all three. What I had told my natural friend Dustin several months ago in my apartment really was true. Learning pickup had enriched so much more than just my sex life. The skills I had amassed in the community made me a much better interviewer than I'd ever been. I discovered just how good when I was assigned an interview with Britney Spears. Chapter 9. Was there a lot of pressure on you while making this album? Britney Spears. What now? Was there a lot of pressure from yourself or the label to have a major hit this time around? I have no idea. You have no idea? I have no idea. I heard you did a track with a DFA that wasn't included on your new CD. Why was that? What's the DFA? They're two producers from New York, James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy, who call themselves the DFA. Does that ring a bell? Yeah, maybe they did something. My interview with Britney Spears was going nowhere. I looked at her, crossing her legs and fidgeting on the hotel room couch next to me. She didn't give a shit. I was just an amount of time blocked off on her calendar, and she was tolerating it, poorly. Her hair was tucked under a white Kangol hat, and her thighs pushed at the seams of her faded blue jeans. She was one of the most desired women in the world, but in person, she looked like a corn-fed Southern sorority girl. She had a beautiful face, lightly and perfectly touched with makeup, but there was something masculine about her. As a sexual icon, she was unintimidating and, I imagined, lonely. A gear slammed down in my head. There was only one way to save this interview. I had to sarge her. No matter what country I was in, or what age or class or race of woman I was talking to, the game always worked. Besides, I had nothing to lose by gaming Britney Spears. The interview couldn't get any more boring. Maybe I'd even get a decent quote I could actually print. I folded my list of questions and put them in my back pocket. I had to treat her like any club girl with attention deficit disorder. The first move was to hook her attention. I'll tell you something about yourself that other people probably don't know, I began. People sometimes see you as shy or bitchy offstage, even though you aren't. Totally, she said. Do you want to know why? Yeah. I was creating what's called the yes ladder, capturing her attention by asking questions that require an obvious affirmative answer. I'm watching your eyes when you talk, and every time you think, they go down and to the left. That means you're a kinesthetic person. You're someone who lives in her feelings. Oh my God, she said, that's totally true. Of course it was. It was one of the value-demonstrating routines I developed. The eye goes to one of seven different positions when someone thinks. Each position means the person is accessing a different part of their brain. As I taught her how to read different types of eye movements, she clung to every word. Her legs uncrossed, and she leaned in toward me. The game was on. I didn't know this, she said. Who told you this? I wanted to tell her, a secret society of international pickup artists. It's something I observed from doing lots of interviews, I answered. In fact, by watching the direction people's eyes move when they speak, you can tell whether they're telling the truth or not. So you're going to know if I'm lying? She was looking at me entirely differently now. I wasn't a journalist anymore. I was someone she could learn from, someone who offered value. I had demonstrated authority over her world. I can tell from your eye movements, from your eye contact, from the way you speak, and from your body language. There's so many different ways to tell. I need to do psychology classes, she said with endearing earnestness. That would be so interesting to me, studying people. It was working. She was opening up. She kept talking and talking. And you could meet somebody or be out on a date and be like, are they lying to me right now? Oh my gosh. It was time to pull out the heavy artillery. I'll show you something really cool, and then we'll get back to the interview, I said, throwing in a time constraint for good measure. It'll be an experiment. I'm going to try to guess something that's in your thoughts. Then I used a simple magic trick to guess the initials of an old friend she had an emotional connection to, someone I wouldn't know and hadn't heard of. The initials were GC, and I got one letter out of two correct. It was a new routine. I was still learning, but it was good enough for her. I can't believe you did that. I probably have so many walls in front, so that's why you didn't get them both, she said. Let's try it one more time. This time, why don't you try it? I'm scared. She put her knuckle in her mouth and pinched the skin between her teeth. She had great teeth. They really were a perfect C shape. I can't do that. She was no longer Britney Spears. She was just a one set, a lone target. Or, as Robert Greene would classify her in his breakdown of Seducer's Victims, she was the lonely leader. We'll make it easier, I said. I'm going to write down a number, and it's a number between 1 and 10. What I want you to do is not to think at all. You need to trust your instincts. There's no special ability required to read minds. Just quiet your internal chatter and really listen to your feelings. I wrote a number on a piece of paper and handed it to her. Now tell me, I said, the first number that you feel. What if it's wrong, she asked. It's probably wrong. This was what we called in the field an LSE girl. She had low self-esteem. What do you think it is? 7, she said. Now turn over the paper, I told her. She slowly turned it over, as if she were afraid to look, then moved it up to eye level and saw a big number 7 staring right back at her. She screamed, leaped off the couch, and ran to the hotel mirror. Her mouth hung agape as she looked her reflection in the eye. Oh my God, she said to her reflection. I did that. It was as if she had to look at herself in the mirror to make sure that what had just happened was real. Whoa, she gasped. I did that. She was like a little girl seeing Britney Spears for the first time. She was her own fan. I just knew that it was 7, she announced as she galloped back to the couch. Of course she knew. That was the first magic trick I learned from mystery. If you have someone choose a number between 1 and 10 randomly, 70% of the time, especially if you rush their decision, that number will be 7. So, yeah, I had tricked her, but her self-esteem needed a good boost. See, I told her, you already know all the answers inside. It's just that society trains you to think too much. I really believed that. Cool interview, she exclaimed. I like this interview. This has been the best interview of my life. Then she turned her face toward mine, looked me in the eye, and asked, can we stop the tape recorder? For the next 15 minutes, we talked about spirituality and writing and our lives. She was just a lost little girl going through a late emotional puberty. She was searching for something real to hold on to, something deeper than pop fame and the sycophancy of her handlers. I had demonstrated value, and now we were moving onto the rapport phase of seduction. Maybe Mystery was right. All human relationships follow the same formula. Rapport equals trust plus comfort. However, I had a job to do. I started the tape recorder and asked the questions I'd given her at the start of the interview, plus all the other questions I had. This time, she gave me real answers, answers I could print. When the hour was up, I stopped the tape recorder. "You know," Brittany said, "everything happens for a reason." "I truly believe that," I told her. "I do too." She touched my shoulder, and a broad smile spread across her face. "I'd like to exchange numbers." Chapter 10. After our hour was up, Brittany left the room to change for an MTV interview. She returned 10 minutes later with her publicist. As she sat down in front of the cameras, her publicist looked at me strangely. "You know, she's never done that with a writer before," she said. "Really?" I asked. She said it was like the two of you were destined to meet. The publicist and I stood next to each other in silence as the MTV interview began. "So you had a crazy time out the other night?" the interviewer asked. "Yeah, I did," Brittany answered. "What was the energy level like in the club when you walked in and surprised everyone?" "Oh, it was just crazy." "And how much fun did you have?" Suddenly, Brittany stood up. "This isn't working," she told the crew. "I'm not feeling this." She pivoted on her heels and walked toward the door, leaving the crew and her assistants befuddled. As she passed me, the corners of her mouth turned upward, forming a conspiratorial smile. I had gotten to her. There was something deeper to Britney Spears than what the pop machine required of her. The game, I realized, works better on celebrities than ordinary people. Because stars are so sheltered and their interactions limited, a demonstration of value or the right neg holds 10 times the power. In the days that followed, I thought often about what had happened. I had no illusions. Britney Spears wasn't attracted to me. She wasn't considering me as a potential mate. But I had interested her, and that was a step in the right direction. Pickup is a linear process. Capture the imagination first, and the heart next. Interest plus attraction plus seduction equals sex. Of course, maybe this was all just self-hypnosis. For all I knew, she exchanged phone numbers with every journalist to make him feel special and ensure a good story. She probably had an answering service set up at that number, specifically for gullible writers who thought they were pickup artists. Or perhaps it was a scheme of the publicists to make journalists think they had a special connection with her artist. Maybe I was the one being sarged, not her. I would never know the truth. I stared at that number every day, but I couldn't bring myself to dial it. I told myself that it was crossing a journalistic line. If she didn't like the piece I was writing, which was quite possible, I didn't want her to go on record saying I had written a bad article because she hadn't phoned back. "Just call her," Mystery constantly prodded me. "What do you have to lose?" "Tell her, can you not look like Britney Spears? We're going to do some crazy shit and we can't get caught. We're going to wear wigs and climb up to the Hollywood sign and touch it for good luck. If I had met her socially, fine, but this is a work assignment." "You're playing the game at another level now," Mystery said. "When the article is finished, it isn't an assignment anymore, so call her." But I couldn't do it. If it had been Daylene Curtis, the Playmate of the Year, I would have called her back in a second. I had no fear of women like that anymore. I felt worthy. I'd proven that over and over since meeting her. But Britney Spears? One's self-esteem can only grow so much in a year and a half. Step 9. Make a physical connection. Chapter 1. It took just one woman to bring Project Hollywood down. By all appearances, Katya was a standard issue party girl. She liked to drink, dance, get high, and have sex, not necessarily in that order. But Katya, perhaps out of innocence, perhaps out of revenge, perhaps out of true love, would outgame every pua in the house. All those years of study, all those memorized routines and learned patterns of behavior, all those new rock platform boots were no match for a woman scorned. When I returned from New York, Mystery had a workshop scheduled in Los Angeles. He was charging $1,500 now, and people were paying. He had 5 students, guaranteeing a healthy profit for a weekend of talking and sarging. Katya's was just one of several numbers he had collected while demonstrating his game during the workshop. He'd met her at a Hollywood bar called Star Shoes. She was very drunk at the time, and quite possibly high. Monday was telephone day at Project Hollywood. Everyone called the numbers they'd collected the previous weekend to see which leads were hot and which had staled. When Mystery made his calls, the only person who picked up the phone was Katya. If Katya hadn't been home, and another one of Mystery's numbers had answered instead, all our lives would have been different. Despite our supposed skill, mating is largely a game of chance. Women are at different places in their lives when we meet them. They may be looking for a boyfriend, a one-night stand, a husband, or a revenge fuck. Or they may be looking for nothing at all, because they're in a happy relationship or recovering from an emotionally destructive one. Katya was probably looking for a place to live. When Mystery called, Katya couldn't remember having met him. Nonetheless, after half an hour of talk, or comfort building, as Mystery put it, she agreed to come over. "Dress casual," Mystery told her. "I'll only be able to hang out for an hour or two." Using words like casual and hangout and the time constraint were all part of a strategy to make the visit a low-pressure event. It's a much better way to get someone to commit to time with a stranger than AFC-style dinner dating, which can be a painful, drawn-out affair that involves two people who may have nothing in common stuck together for an entire night of awkward conversation. Katya arrived that evening wearing a pink sweatsuit and dragging along a scrappy little terrier named Lily. Both Katya and Lily instantly made themselves at home. The former collapsed into the pillow pit, and the latter took a shit on the carpet. Mystery popped out of his room in jeans, a long-sleeved black t-shirt, and his hair in a ponytail. "I'm just gonna hook my computer up to the projector and show you some movies I made," he told her. "No worries, no troubles," Katya replied in an upbeat Russian accent. She had a button nose that wiggled, puffy cheeks that flared, and blonde hair that bounced to maximize her cuteness. Mystery dimmed the lights and showed her our home movies. They were becoming a popular routine around the house because they allowed us to convey positive qualities about ourselves and our friends without even talking. After movie time, Mystery and Katya massaged each other and made out. On their second meeting, 3 days later, after much LMR, PUA jargon for last-minute resistance, they closed the deal. "I'm moving out of my apartment," she told Mystery afterward. "So is it okay if Lily stays here while I go to Las Vegas this weekend?" Leaving Lily at the house was a cunning tactic, because while Katya was gone, we all grew attached to the cheery, lovable dog, and by extension, to its owner as well. Their personalities were similar. They were both bouncy and energetic, and liked licking Mystery's face. When Katya returned from Las Vegas, Mystery helped her move out of her old house. "I think it's completely ridiculous for you to rent a new apartment, knowing that you'll be spending most of your time with me," he told her. "So why don't you just move into my room?" All she had to her name were two duffel bags, a makeup kit, Lily, and a Mazda SUV stuffed with clothing and shoes. As far as anyone knew, she had no job or source of income, though she'd modeled for a couple of low-budget swimsuit calendars. In the evenings, she went to school to learn special effects makeup. Every night after class, she'd prance around the house with fake rope burns around her neck, or artificial brain spilling out of a flesh wound in her forehead, or the wrinkles and liver spots of a 90-year-old woman. Katya quickly wove herself into the fabric of the house. She volunteered to be a pivot for Papa's workshops. She put eyeliner on Herbal before he went out for the night. She cleaned the kitchen that we were all too lazy to deal with ourselves. She went clothes shopping with Zanius, and she played hostess to Playboy's parties. She had an amazing ability to befriend anyone, though her motivation was unclear. Maybe she was genuinely a people-loving person. Maybe she enjoyed the free rent. Either way, she was giving the home its first rays of warmth and camaraderie since the night we'd moved in and sat in the jacuzzi, dreaming of the future together. I liked her. We all liked her. We even let her brother, a shaggy-haired 16-year-old with Tourette's syndrome, sleep in the pillow pit for a few weeks. Mystery was particularly happy with himself. He hadn't dated anyone seriously since Patricia. "I actually have a crush on my own girlfriend," he said with pride one evening, showing Katya's swimsuit calendar picture to a group of random sargers. "I think of her constantly, like when you have a baby. I have a very strong nurturing instinct. I need to take care of this girl and make sure she's safe." Later that night, as Herbal cooked steak on the barbecue, Katya and I sat in the jacuzzi, sharing a bottle of wine. I'm really scared, she said. Why? I asked, though I really knew why. I'm starting to fall in love with Mystery. Well, he's a talented and amazing guy. Yeah, she said. I never let myself fall in love like this. I don't know enough about him yet. I'm worried. Then she sat there quietly. She wanted me to say something, to warn her if she was making a mistake. I didn't say anything. A few days later, Mystery and Katya flew to Las Vegas. Katya called me soon after they arrived. Hey, is something wrong? I asked her. No, Mystery wants to marry me. He got down on his knees at the Hard Rock Pool and proposed. Everyone applauded. It was so sweet. What should I do? Mystery grabbed the phone. Hey, man, you're going to get really mad at me. We're getting married. I love this girl. She's crazy. We're on our way to the chapel. Okay, bye. The guy was an idiot. That evening, Mystery carried Katya over the threshold of Project Hollywood, humming Here Comes the Bride. They'd known each other for 3 weeks. Look at my ring, Katya cooed. Isn't it beautiful? Our rings cost $8,000, Mystery said with pride. That was basically all the cash he had. Though he was raking in money from his workshops, he was a fan of man toys. Computers, digital cameras, electronic organizers, basically anything with a chip. This whole marriage thing, Mystery told me while Katya was in the bathroom, is the best routine ever. She loves me now. She gets off on calling me her husband. It's like a time distortion. Dude, it's the worst routine ever, I replied, because you can only do it once. Mystery took a step toward me and removed his ring. I'm going to tell you a secret, he whispered, putting the ring in my hand. We're not really married. If any other Pua had told me he'd gotten married in Vegas to a girl he'd just met, I would have known it was a joke. But Mystery was so headstrong and unpredictable that I had given him the benefit, or more accurately, the detriment, of the doubt. Don't tell Katya I told you, Mystery continued. I think she's really enjoying the role play. On an emotional level, it's the same as really being married for her. Mystery was right. Perception is reality. In the days that followed, their entire relationship changed. They actually started acting like an old married couple. Now that he was living with a woman, Mystery didn't feel the need to go out anymore. To him, clubs were for sarging. To Katya, though, they were for dancing. So she started going clubbing without him. After a while, Mystery hardly left his room, or for that matter, his bed. It was hard to tell whether he was just being lazy or if a depression was coming on. There's a pattern the pickup artists have called rocks versus gold. It's a speech a man gives a woman he's dating when she stops having sex with him. He tells her that women in a relationship want rocks, or diamonds, while men seek gold. Rocks, for a woman, are nice dinners, romantic attention, and emotional connection. Gold, for a man, is sex. If you give a woman gold or a man rocks, neither will be satisfied. There must be an exchange. And Katya was giving Mystery the gold, but he wasn't giving her the rocks. He wasn't taking her out at all. It wasn't long before they began to resent each other. He'd say, "She gets drunk every night. It's driving me crazy." She'd say, "When I met him, he had all these plans and ambitions. Now he never leaves his bed. What's the point?" He'd say, "She never shuts up. She's constantly yapping about something pointless and bouncing off the walls." She'd say, "I'm getting wasted every night because I don't want to be in a reality that's so sad." Mystery needed a more passive girl. Katya needed a more active man. And it saddened the rest of us. After living in a house full of men for so many months, we'd grown attached to her positive energy and high spirits. Mystery had taught himself everything there was to know about pickup, but nothing about how to maintain a relationship. He had this beautiful creature, full of sparkle and life, and he was just throwing it away. Soon, another woman, with a very different kind of sparkle, would move into Project Hollywood. I received the text message at 11:39 p.m. "Can I stay at your house?" "They repoed the car and worse. You don't want to know. Need to not be alone." It was Courtney Love. Chapter 2. I knocked on the door of Courtney's corporate apartment in West Los Angeles. "Come in, it's open." Courtney sat on the floor in the middle of a sea of American Express bills and bank statements with a yellow highlighter in her hand. She wore a black Marc Jacobs dress with buttons running down the side. One was missing. "I can't look at these anymore," she moaned. There are so many loans here that I never knew of or approved. She stood up and slammed an American Express bill on the table. Half the items were highlighted, with notes in black ink scribbled in the margins. If I stay here, I'll do drugs again, she cried. She didn't have a manager, and taking care of her own affairs was proving to be more than she could handle. I don't want to be alone, she begged. I need somewhere to stay for a couple days. Then I'll be out of your hair, I promise. That's fine. I guess she didn't have a problem with the story I'd written in Rolling Stone. Herbal said you could sleep in his room. I just want to warn you, though, that you're not going into an ordinary house. I know. I want to meet the pickup artists. Maybe they can help me. I walked her downstairs and strapped her 60-pound suitcase to the luggage rack on the back of my Corvette. You should also know that Koch's brother is staying with us, I said. And if he seems a little off, it's because he has Tourette's. Is that like when you yell shitballs uncontrollably? Yeah, it's sort of like that. I parked in the garage and dragged her suitcase upstairs to the house. The first person we saw inside was Herbal, who was coming out of the kitchen. Hi, shitballs, Courtney said to him. No, I told her, that's not Koch's brother. Her brother walked out of the kitchen a moment later, sipping a Coke. Hi, shitballs, Courtney said to him. She took a step backward and stepped on Lily, who yelped loudly. Courtney turned around. I assumed she was going to apologize. Fuck off, she told the dog. This was going to be an interesting couple of days. I showed her around the house and then bid her goodnight. 2 minutes later, she marched into my room. I need a toothbrush, she said as she breezed through to my bathroom. There's a clean one in the medicine cabinet, I yelled after her. This'll do, she snapped back, grabbing my gnarly used toothbrush off the sink. There was something endearing about her. She possessed a trait nearly every pickup artist desired but lacked. She just didn't give a fuck. The next morning, I came downstairs to find her in the living room, smoking a cigarette and wearing nothing but a pair of expensive Japanese silk panties. Her body was covered with black marks, as if she'd been rolling around in charcoal. In that state of dishabille, she met the rest of the house. I used to ride horses with your dad, Papa told her when I introduced them. Courtney scowled. If you call that man my father again, I'll punch you in the face. She wasn't trying to be mean. She just lived in and reacted to the moment. But Papa didn't take well to aggression. All Papa had wanted, from the day he'd signed the lease to Project Hollywood, was to hang out with celebrities. But now that he was living with one, in fact, the most notorious woman in the country at the time, he was petrified of her. He avoided her from that day forward, like he did everyone else who wasn't part of his pickup business. Next, Courtney met Katya. I just took a pregnancy test, Katya told her, puckering her lips into a childish expression of self-pity. It came out positive. You should have the baby, Courtney said. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. I was living the surreal life. Chapter 3. Mystery kneeled in front of Katya and kissed her belly. If you want to keep the baby, whether we are together forever or not, I will support your decision. It would be a beautiful baby. The sun poured into the kitchen from the patio, illuminating a thin, orderly chain of ants that ran from the brickwork outside to the overflowing trash can inside. Before he stood up, Mystery licked his finger and wiped a thin stripe of saliva through the middle of the chain. The ants went scurrying in every direction at the point of rupture. I can't even believe you'd think of keeping the baby, Katya replied, her voice chirpy but scornful. You're weird, you're acting like we're really married. The ants began to fall back into line. Soon order was restored. It was hard to tell there had ever been a catastrophe. I love you, Mystery said without emotion, and you know my mission in life, survive and replicate. So I don't see any harm in having the baby. I'm willing to fulfill my half of the obligation. Our house wasn't self-organizing like a line of ants. There was no chain of command or unspoken structure. The invisible chemical path we were all following smelled like male hormones, and its natural state was disorder. All afternoon, Mystery and Katya fought with each other over whether she should have an abortion and who should pay for it. These matters, however, are not group decisions. So Katya and Mystery went to an abortion clinic 3 days later. Guess what? Katya squealed when she returned. I'm not pregnant. She jumped into the air and clapped her hands together in praise of luck. Mystery stood behind her, giving her the finger. The look on his face was pure hatred. I'd never seen him display such malevolence toward a woman before. A few hours later, I found Katya at the bar, pouring herself a glass of Chardonnay. Then another, then another. Mystery doesn't come out of the room, and he doesn't fuck, she complained. So I'm gonna have a good time tonight without him. You deserve it. Come drink with me, she cooed. That's all right. No worries, no troubles. She took a slow sip of wine and sat next to me on the couch. Wow, she said. You really have been working out. Your arms look good. Thanks. One of the things I'd learned in the past year and a half was how to take a compliment. Just say, thank you. It's the only response a confident person can make. She sidled up to me and squeezed my biceps. You're the only person in the house I can talk to. Her face was inches away from mine. I felt that tingle of energy, the one I'd felt just before I kissed the hostess Tyler Durden had picked up at the Hard Rock. Look at this, she said. She was lifting her top now. I got a scratch. That's nice. Here, feel it. She took my hand and pulled it toward her breast. I really had to get going. Well, it's been fun talking, but I have to go to my room and floss my cat. But you don't have a cat, she whined. I circled around to the back of the house and entered Mystery's room through the patio. He was lying on top of his bed in jeans with a laptop computer resting on his bare stomach. He was watching Back to the Future 2. When I was in 10th grade, I wanted to kill myself because I had nothing left to live for, he said. Then I heard that Back to the Future 2 was opening in 23 days. I had a calendar, and I would mark off each day until I could see the movie. It's the only thing that kept me from killing myself. He paused the movie and lifted the laptop off his stomach. When I saw it and heard the opening music, I cried, dude. It was my reason to live. I know all the props. He held up the DVD box and showed me the cover. I touched this car. I sat down at the foot of his bed. No one wants to be the bearer of bad news. I picked up the DVD box and looked at it. Mystery liked movies like Real Genius and Young Einstein and The Karate Kid. I liked Werner Herzog, Lars von Trier, and Pixar. It didn't mean I was better than him. It just meant we were different kinds of nerds. Dude, I told him, your wife is hitting on me. I'm not surprised. She hit on Playboy earlier tonight. Aren't you going to do anything about it? I don't care. She can do what she wants. Well, at least she's not pregnant. Get this, he said. She's such an idiot. That wasn't a pregnancy test at all. It was an ovulation test. She bought the wrong box at Rite Aid. She took the test 3 times and each one was positive. So all she discovered was that at 23, she's still ovulating. Listen, man. I noticed there were scratches on his arm. You're driving her away. If she's hitting on everyone in the house, it's only because she's trying to get revenge on you. It's rocks versus gold, man. You haven't been giving her rocks. Yeah, she's a brainless alcoholic. He paused, shut his eyes for a moment, and nodded wistfully. But that body, her ass is a 10. When I left Mystery's room, Katya was no longer in the living room. Papa's door was open, and she was cuddled next to him on the bed, with her top off. I retreated to my room and waited. An hour later, the storm came. Voices yelled, doors slammed, glass smashed. There was a knock on the door. It was Courtney. Are your roommates always this loud? She was one to talk. I followed Courtney to Herbal's room. Herbal had been sleeping in the pillow pit while Courtney commandeered his room. Clothes, books, and cigarette ash were spread across the floor. A candle sat burning at the foot of the bed, its flame licking just an inch below the comforter. One of her dresses was draped over a hot, exposed light bulb for mood lighting, and all 4 of the house phone books were spread across her bed, with pages torn out of each. I examined the ripped scraps. They were listings for lawyers. The noises coming from Mystery's room grew louder. Let's see what's going on, she said. I didn't want to be involved. I didn't want to clean up anyone's mess. This wasn't my fucking responsibility. We walked into Mystery's bathroom. Katya was kneeling on the floor with her hands clasped around her neck as if she were choking. Her brother was leaning over her, holding an asthma inhaler in her mouth. Mystery stood a few feet away, staring daggers at Katya. Should I call an ambulance? I asked. They'll arrest her because she has drugs in her system, Mystery said contemptuously. Katya looked up and glared at him. If she had the presence of mind to glare at Mystery, then she clearly wasn't dying. When Katya finally emerged from Mystery's room, her face red and damp, Courtney took her by the hand and led her to a sofa in the living room. She sat down next to her, still gripping her hand, and told her about the abortion she had been through and about the beauty of childbirth. I looked at the unlikely pair sitting there. Courtney was both Project Hollywood's child and its mother. She was also probably the sanest person in the house, and that was a scary thought. Chapter 4. The next morning, Courtney burst out of her door at an atypically early hour. She was wearing an Agent Provocateur nightie.
"What? What's going on?"
she asked, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes. "I had a bad dream. I didn't know where I was." She looked around, at me, at Katya sleeping on the sofa, at Katya's brother and Herbal snoring inches apart in the pillow pit. "Everyone's nice," she observed with relief. "No one's mean. Okay." She returned to her room and shut her door. A few minutes later, a driver arrived at the house. "Where's Courtney?" he asked. "Sleeping," I said. "She's got a court date in an hour." He knocked on her door and walked inside. Shortly afterward, a slew of dresses came tumbling out of Courtney's room, followed by their owner. "I need to find something to wear to court," she said as she slipped on various outfits, running in and out of the bathroom to check them in the mirror. Eventually, she left the house in a strapless black cocktail dress of Katya's, Herbal's $8 sunglasses, and Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power book tucked under her arm. "It's a silly dress because it's a silly case," she told court reporters that day. While she was gone, we inspected the damage. There were cigarette burns in Herbal's bedspread, and the wall behind the door was destroyed from the constant slamming. There were slicks of unidentifiable liquid on the floor, candles still burning, and clothing flung over every light fixture. In the kitchen, the refrigerator and cabinet doors all hung open. Two peanut butter jars and a jelly jar sat on the countertop, with their caps scattered on the floor. Globs of peanut butter dripped from the counter, the cabinets, and the refrigerator shelves. Rather than open bags of bread using the twist tie on the end, she had torn the tops of the plastic bags open like an animal. She didn't give a fuck. She was hungry. She ate. It was another quality that pickup artists admired. She could go caveman. When Courtney returned from court, she sat with the house's cabal of pickup artists and planned her appearance that evening on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Mystery and Herbal taught her about concepts like social proof and NLP ideas like framing. She needed to be reframed. The current frame everyone saw her through was that of a crazy woman. But having lived with her for 2 weeks, we knew she was just going through a bad period. She was eccentric, but not crazy. In fact, she was incredibly smart. She understood and internalized every concept they taught her. "So my new frame, then, is that I'm a damsel in distress," she said. That evening, she shone on The Tonight Show. Unlike during her tabloid headline-making Letterman appearance, she was composed and well-behaved on camera, and her performance with her all-female band, The Chelsea, was a reminder that she wasn't just a celebrity, she was a rock star. I had driven to the show in Katya's car with Herbal, Mystery, Katya, and Kara, a girl I'd met in a bar a couple days before. After the show, we went upstairs to Courtney's dressing room, where she was sitting on a stool, surrounded by the Chelsea. I was stunned by her guitarist. She was a tall, gorgeous, bleach blonde rock and roller, oozing attitude. Why couldn't I ever find girls like that in the clubs? "Can I stay in your room for 2 more weeks?" Courtney asked Herbal. "Sure," he replied. Herbal never had a problem with anything or anyone. While Mystery had been moping in his room, he was out helping Katya keep her brother entertained. "It may be a month," Courtney called after us as we left the room. Chapter 5. It was bound to happen. Katya eventually reached someone in the house. She'd been hitting on all of us since her pregnancy scare. It was Herbal who ultimately cracked. He was laid back. He never lost his cool. He liked to listen. He was modest and understated. In other words, he was the exact opposite of Mystery. All that time he had spent with Katya, while Mystery was pouting or laying indolently in bed or sleeping with a stripper out of revenge, had affected him. He had developed feelings for Katya. After watching her suffer through Mystery's manipulation and neglect, he'd even begun to believe that he was more worthy of her. "It's just getting harder and harder to say no," he told me. "Just ask Mystery, he's probably over her by now," Yeah, after all, he was cool with the whole Sima thing. Sima was Mystery's ex-MLTR from Toronto, who Herbal had fooled around with. So Herbal asked Mystery. The answer was no. But that evening, after fighting with Katya again, Mystery found Herbal in the living room. "We're broken up," he said casually. "She's all yours." They were words he would soon regret. Within hours, Herbal had his dick inside her. Since Courtney was sleeping in his bed, he fucked her in Playboy's room off the kitchen. When Mystery returned that night from the Standard, he went to the kitchen for a Sprite. That was when he heard them. The moans that had been his exclusive nightly serenade were being sung for another man. He stood outside Playboy's door in shock, listening to them have sex. Katya seemed to be enjoying it. Loudly. Mystery walked into the living room and collapsed on the floor. The blood drained from his face. Like his father's death, it affected him more than he could have predicted. Never underestimate your own capacity to care. "I love her," he said, as the first tear trickled down his cheek. "I love that girl." "No, you don't," I corrected him. "You said the other day that you hated her." The thoughts I'd been holding back for weeks came pouring out of me. "All you like about her is her body. The only reason you're upset is because you feel rejected." "No, I'm pissed at her for not loving me back." "She loved you more than any other girl I've seen you with. She sat with me in the hot tub one night, talking about how scared she was to let go and really love you. And as soon as she did, you became a cold, shut down, miserable bastard." "But I love her." "You say that about every girl you sleep with. That's not real love. It's fake love. It's an illusion." "No, it isn't," he screamed at the top of his lungs. "You're wrong." He stood up, stomped to his room, and slammed the door, splintering paint onto the carpet. He'd been so neglected as a child that the withdrawal of love pulled all his emotional triggers, exploding the carapace of narcissism built by his childhood escapism. As I walked back to my room, a scene from The Wizard of Oz sprung into my head, in which the wizard tells the Tin Man, "A heart is not judged by how much you love, but by how much you are loved by others." I was looking forward to letting my dreams file away all my thoughts, worries, and aggravations so I could start the next day fresh. But I was waylaid by Courtney. She stood in my doorway, a sheaf of papers in her hand. "You gotta get Frank Abnegale on the phone for me," she demanded. "He can fix this. And call Lisa and tell her I need to see her." "You got it." I had no idea what she was talking about. I didn't know how to get in touch with Frank Abnegale, the counterfeit artist whose memoirs inspired the movie Catch Me If You Can, or for that matter, Lisa, her guitarist. But by now, I'd figured out how to deal with Courtney's constant demands. Just say yes and do nothing. She'd forget what she wanted in a few hours anyway. In the morning, I checked on Mystery. He was sitting on his bed in his robe, shaking and convulsing. His face was red, and his eyes were full of tears. I'd never seen him like this before. When he was depressed in Toronto, he'd simply shut down and become catatonic. This time, he seemed to be in real pain. "I want to kill her." He rolled onto his back and moaned like a dying dog. "Logically, I know I'm being controlled by my emotions, but my logic is just 2% right now. I feel emotionally raw." He clenched his bedsheet in his fist. "I feel strange and empty, like after a shit." He rolled over and started sobbing again. "I feel shit empty." I would have laughed if he were trying to be funny. As he grieved, I kept thinking of one of Courtney Love's lyrics. "I made my bed, I'll lie in it." Mystery had made his bed, and now Herbal was lying in it. He raised his hands to the ceiling and screamed in his Anthony Robbins voice. Suddenly, Courtney poked her head in the door. "Is it about me? I can sleep in the front room if you want." She could be so sweet. I walked into the living room and told Courtney what was going on. Katya was sitting on the patio outside, smoking a cigarette and crying. Herbal shuffled to the table with his head slumped forward. He was silent, trying to think of something to say. Neither of them seemed to regret sleeping together. They just didn't realize that Mystery would take it so hard. None of us did. Courtney lit a cigarette and told Herbal about a threesome she'd experienced and how sharing can be caring. Just then, Herbal's phone rang. He answered it and, with a shocked expression on his face, handed it to Courtney. "It's Frank Abnegale calling for you," he said. "I guess he got my message." I left the three of them on the patio and called Mystery's sister, Martina. "He's starting to crash again," I said. "How bad is it?" "It started off like normal heartbreak, but but this morning he went over the edge. The situation seems to have triggered some kind of chemical reaction. He's crying uncontrollably right now. Well, if it gets any worse, I'll get him a ticket back to Toronto. If you can put him on a plane, we'll take care of him when he arrives. You realize that if he comes back to Toronto, everything will be lost. He's overstayed his visa here, so they'll never let him into the United States again. He'll have no chance of becoming a famous illusionist, and his pickup business will be destroyed. I realize that, but what choice do we have, she said. I'll try to handle it myself. Just send him home. Healthcare in Canada is free. We can't afford to take him anywhere in the States, especially if they institutionalize him. Let me try. If it gets worse, I'll send him back to you. Watching Mystery's relationship with Katya unfold had been an eye-opener. He invited her to move in. He married her. He got her not pregnant. He ignored her and resented her. He gave Herbal permission to sleep with her. He was no one's victim but his own. In the meantime, ever since the New York Times article, half a dozen reality TV executives had called Mystery, including the producers of American Idol. VH1 had even sent him a contract for a show in